Hi, Gabe.
Sammy, it's been a while.
It has been.
Yeah, it's good to see you today.
How the hell are you?
I'm feeling good, man. I just flew back into town from South Dakota.
Really?
I was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I did the Snow Jam Comedy Festival.
Snow Jam.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what they love in South Dakota? Pizza. Mm-hmm. They can't get enough. It's like the food of the state.
Pizza?
Pizza and broasted chicken.
Broasted?
Which is kind of, it's trademarked. So, yeah, you can't make broasted chicken without a special sort of deep, like a deep fryer.
Okay.
But it's a very moist, patented method of sort of frying your chicken.
Is it like when you deep fry a turkey and that same, it's like hot oil and liquid and then you put it in and it just boils the crap out of it?
I think it might be like a broiled, roasted fried
chicken.
Yeah,
that's what deep frying a turkey is. It's not like people sort of...
Really crispy and tasty on the outside.
But like
flavorful.
Juicy, right?
So juicy.
Yeah, that's the difference, man. When you brine something and then you roast and you kind of hot roast it at searing temperatures... people assume that deep frying means crispy on the outside like fried chicken, but it's quite the opposite.
We were at Boss's Comedy Club in Sioux Falls, and I think I had broasted chicken for late lunch, dinner, and then post-show midnight snack.
That's a lot of pollo, buddy.
I'm 58% pollo right now.
Mucho pollo.
Yes, and the whole time I just thought, you know, dinosaurs evolved into birds, mm-hmm. and so right now I'm eating like a little baby T-Rex. 1999. That's
right.
That's the year that we're tackling today, Sam. And you know why?
Because I have an idea.
Well, we were on a, you know, text thread looking for movies to watch, mm-hmm. and. You floated the idea of The Talented Mr. Ripley.
I did. It was on Netflix. I was like, you know what? I don't want to pay right now.
Yeah, so why not check out one of these films that's streaming on on Netflix? The Talented Mr. Ripley, I didn't see it when it came out.
So this is your first watch?
It is my first watch. I think I watched it twice for this.
Okay.
You know?
Cool.
Just to really soak in all of the Matt Damon's magnificent acting.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, first time.
Yeah.
I missed it when it came out in the theaters, 1999, because I was in college.
Right.
And I was partying like it was 1999.
I feel like in the late 90s, I wasn't going to the theater very often.
Who had money for that?
Nobody did.
No, I think the only movie I saw that year in the theater was The Matrix.
That sounds right. I think I saw Deep Blue Sea.
Okay. Uh-huh. My head is like a shark's fin.
Correct.
Is the song from that LL Cool J performed.
It's true.
Yeah.
You can never forget that.
Sure. I know. It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't at all. Especially since his head is round and super bald.
But I love Deep Blue Sea. I feel like that is the actual sequel to Jaws. You could get rid of all of the other sequels and just have it be Jaws 1, Deep Blue Sea.
I mean, it was cool watching, you know, the CGI sharks were so much cooler looking.
Sure.
Fun.
I like them. They were smart,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, and, they made their brains larger, and as a byproduct, they became smarter.
Sure.
Who'd have thunk it?
Yeah, yeah. Always moving. Right. Never stop moving. Yeah. I follow the shark philosophy. I think if I got a tattoo, it would be of a shark.
I actually referred to you as a shark earlier today, oddly enough.
Yeah, man. Well, that's what happens when you're in the precarious gig economy, freelancing mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah.
You just can't stop moving, you know, because tomorrow is not guaranteed.
All you do is eat, network, and make little networks. If you stop networking, you die. You drown.
1999, let me tell you what came out. SpongeBob SquarePants.
Oh, is that 99?
Yeah, he premieres
in
99. So how about that? Another underwater creature.
Yeah, technically he wasn't underwater.
Everywhere, ubiquitous.
Yeah.
I see him. It's hilarious to see him in the Bronx when I'm like traveling on the 4 train or the 6 train.
Yeah.
And just seeing like hard-ass dudes wearing like SpongeBob leather jackets.
Some people just love him. It was basically like the equivalent of like the old Looney Tunes shirts, sort of the hip-hop.
Right.
Looney Tunes shirts back in the day in like the early 90s. You remember those?
It's like, hey, Holmes, you know I'm crazy. Check out my Bugs Bunny.
Look at Bugs Bunny wearing backwards pants like crisscross.
Same thing. Yeah. So SpongeBob beloved in all sectors of our community.
Cartoon appropriation.
And we got Napster. Napster was a big deal.
Napster was.
So there we were, peer-to-peer file sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of was that whole era, I feel like, the early 2000s, starting in 99. Yeah. It's just swapping and stealing files, BitTorrenting.
Some people might call it the death of good music.
Sure.
I think we've talked before about how bad the music was in that period of time. Number one song, 1999, Smooth by Carlos Santana and Rob Thomas.
Sure.
From Matchbox 20. Britney Spears and NSYNC were topping the charts. Eminem, Finger Bang Palooza, Woodstock 99. We've covered a little bit in the past.
Yeah, shout outs. Best place to throw a multiple day rock music festival is sort of an open air, hot asphalt parking lot.
Right, designer drug fest.
Yeah, so that the sun just bounces right off the asphalt onto you and
your eyes.
Massively dehydrated and angry the whole time. And, have no shade.
No, none.
$10 bottled water at the concession stand. Make that a thing.
Amazing. Best way to test your high school relationship foundation.
Well, you know what? Boris Yeltsin resigned as the president of Russia.
He did.
Said, I've had enough.
Right.
He punched his card for the last time and walked off into the sunset to continue guzzling vodka.
Just slugging vodka.
Sure.
Butt chugs.
And that was when a new force emerged in Russia. The one, the only, Mr. VP, Vladimir Putin.
Pootsie.
First stepped on the scene to become the boogeyman for the United States for the last 20 years.
The benevolent nepotist?
Sure. They wanted a strongman after all of the instability that our sort of austerity politics and opening to the global markets created in Russia.
He literally handcrafted about, 300 different oligarchs.
Yeah.
Made all of his friends billionaires.
Sure. Well, that's what you got to do, man.
Yeah, I get it. It's putting your team on. you put on a bunch of little bleaks.
Yeah, if one of us makes it, dude, if I make it, you got a job.
Float me a mill. Mm-hmm. Big Mouth Billy Bass, the singing plastic fish, was introduced and then immortalized in our favorite television series.
The Sopranos.
Correct.
That's right. Yes. I think my father got a kick out of that. You know, he's an avid fly fisherman, and so my sister bought him one of those.
Oh, that's your heat of the Montana trips.
Sure,
yeah. I've heard all about those. Yeah. Al Green said he received more royalties from the Billy Mouth singing Take Me to the River than any other recording of any of his songs. So he made more money off the bass.
Than he did off Pulp Fiction soundtrack.
Right.
Yeah.
Or just, anything in general.
Uh-huh. That's fun. What's my legacy? Oh, yeah, this singing toy trout.
That may or may not have been a government informant, but definitely was.
Al Green was, or was?
No, the fish. Billy Mouth Bass is a big pussy's
Sure.
Manifested character.
American Pie came out.
Mm-hmm.
People were watching that. That movie made having sex with an apple pie a big deal.
Right.
Maybe a cherry pie.
I always called your high school growing up, because I had friends that went there, the American Pie High School.
It is true, because I came from an all-boys high school, and then I transferred in 11th grade to this co-ed school. And it was the first time that I had been in co-ed school and in high school, and everybody was much dumber. Because all the guys were dumbing themselves down. Everybody was dumbing themselves down to be friendly with each other.
Right.
And it was the first time I felt like I was in like a Saved by the Bell episode.
Yeah, it kind of felt like that.
Like a lot of smiles, really happy, primary colors, well lit. Because like the all boys Catholic school I went to before that felt like a monastery out of Seven. Like we had crucifixes on the walls and stuff. But at the all-boys school, it was like modern art interpretations of Christianity. So there were these welded together metal, angular, sharp, Picasso-like crucifixes. And these Picasso-esque images of saints. Mm-hmm. So it was like definitely out of some medieval Hieronymus Bosch painting.
Right. The Garden of Eden.
Yeah, and to go from that to this Noxzema commercial high school, I was like, what?
Like a polio string cheese commercial.
Yeah, it was like just a bunch of kids out of an Apple Jacks commercial being like, we're kids, we eat what we like.
Everyone's driving Jeep Cherokees.
Sure.
At the other school, the Catholic one, did they pump Gregorian chants during down the hallways?
Yeah, Dude, I had monks.
Yeah.
They were Benedictine monks that were floating down the hallways. I didn't see their feet. They just looked like they levitated off the ground a little bit.
For Jim, spice it up, put some Enigma on. question your own sexuality.
But you know what? We all read. Everybody good. Read.
And yeah, everybody gets their shit done.
I think a big difference is like at the Catholic the boys' school, we all, it didn't matter what you did, there was no hierarchy of like jocks and nerds. Like one kid drew really well, it was like, oh, that guy draws, and another kid played, you know, a recorder or yeah. violin, and it was fine. And then the guy who played basketball sat at the table with all of us. It was just,
I mean, you guys were all probably hyper productive because there was no temptations of the flesh
right
to distract
right.
you
right no apples rolling in front of us keeping us from reading our Latin texts. No, it's fine though. It's fine. We, 1999 was the year that, oh,
Phantom Menace came out.
Yeah, that's it, man. Mm-hmm. That was a really cool year too. I thought I had so much hope. I had so much hope that it would be a good, Star Wars film.
What was your first inkling that it was not going to be?
Maybe the first, 15 minutes.
I was just going to ask you. That's probably it. That little kid.
And then, but then, you know, we're like, well, okay, let's throw a good money after bad. Maybe we'll just wait for the next one to come out. It'll mm-hmm. be good. It'll be good. And I was in college, so we're like terrorizing, women in our dorm who had never seen Star Wars. And we're running around being like, no, you have to understand. You have to watch Return of the Jedi. It's great. Oh, no.
Oh, so they're only...
Yeah, because they hadn't known. Right. They were like, they hadn't seen Star Wars, the first three. And so we're trying to get ladies to come out with us to the new Star Wars Phantom Menace. And they're like, what? This is the fourth one in the series? I don't know what you're talking about.
But how are the first ones 3 through 5? Yeah, it's tough to follow. Also, if you don't give a shit, even harder to follow. The first time I ever saw the original Star Wars movies was 1999, actually. I was at school in Oregon and decided to watch them.
Sure, back to back to back?
I watched them, yeah, within a couple of the matter of a couple of days. I like the second one.
Yeah.
The darker one.
That's the one, yeah, that's the good one.
The Empire Strikes Back, is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Sure.
Where he hollows out that, whatever that thing is, and sleeps in it, Revenant style. Yeah.
Yeah, I fantasize about that.
Yeah, never been a big science fiction guy. I think that's you'll notice a dearth.
Every time I'm walking around now, and there's an Arctic vortex, mm-hmm. a polar blast in New York, I look around for like large creatures and
to hollow out.
Yeah, is there mm-hmm. one that I could just gut and get inside of?
What
and
have make, you like, what a have carcass you found?
Sleeping bag out mm-hmm. of them? Well, you know those police cop horses in. In Central Park, if I'm walking through there, I'm like, I could just kill this cop and then gut that horse and sleep in it.
Right.
If it's, you know, not, oh, I don't think that all the time. I'm not a creep. Mm-hmm. I just think that when it's like.
Just when it's about cops.
When there's like a cold wind chill.
Mm-hmm.
When it's a brisk day.
I'm going to murder this cop. I'm going to hollow out your horse.
Sleep in it. All right.
Cops getting no love on the Eat, Pray, Judge podcast.
Yeah. I mean, we'll pull back, but yeah. So,
who's we?
Well, if they stop doing terrible things,
I mean, you know,
I'd praise them more. But every time I scroll on Facebook, somebody else is getting choked up at a pool party.
Biggest motherfucking gang out here, buddy.
Yeah. The talented Mr. Ripley.
Yes.
This is it's post-war 1950s America. Mm-hmm. It's the Empire Abroad, and we are dominating the world, mm-hmm. and Europe is the playground for our idle rich youth.
Yeah.
Jazz is the sound of the American hip individualists. And, well, you know, I'd say what, though? Jazz probably was handed – the CIA did have a cultural agenda,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, the Soviet Union was a big deal. And there were socialist parties that were operating in Western Europe. And the U.S. didn't want them to get a foothold. And they thought, well, one of the best things that we have that we can put out there to get people to love America is our culture. So this, I do believe that the CIA was helping promote jazz along with abstract art.
You mean the culture of Black Americans?
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. But that the musical... style in and of itself represents individuality
because uh-huh.
it's all about zip zap zopping.
Because it's six dudes playing six different songs at the same time.
Exactly, right. Exactly. So it's not a communal effort. Mm-hmm. It's everybody shining on their own
improvisation.
And then when you have abstract art, which is just like, hey man, my splatters are my splatters. Mm. You know, look at me. Just check Jackson Pollock out as the individual. That all is a way to promote our ideology.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought about that in that light.
Sure. So this film is takes place in the 50s, and a brief synopsis is we've got Matt Damon plays the talented Mr. Ripley, and he is he's got to go on a mission to Italy to bring back Jude Law, who is playing Dickie Greenleaf, the son, scion, and heir to the Greenleaf shipping fortune. And he's frittering away his inheritance on the beaches of Mangibello, Italy. And Mr. Ripley, Matt Damon, has to bring him back home. And that's it. That's the mission.
Yeah. Also known as the Andrew Cunanan origin story.
And why would you say that, Sammy? I don't know who this Andrew Cunanan is.
Let me tell you about Andrew Cunanan. He was a... He comes from like a middle class background, I guess, and sort of latched on to older gay millionaires, and as a gay man himself, charmed them, and then you know, left a trail of murdered wealthy gay men in his wake, including
including who?
Gianni Versace.
Yeah,
he ingratiates himself, digs himself into the circle, becomes part of their inner workings, their daily life. Mirrors, mimics them, brags, name drops. Not quite to the extent, or more so than Thomas Ripley did, but.
Yeah, so that's the story of sort of a social climber who learns all of the signifiers and and the cultural valuable touchstones of the upper class.
He's enamored with wealth and extravagance and glamour and a lifestyle that he couldn't provide himself, so he... found out, they latched on the way that he could.
Yeah, so Matt Damon's Mr. Ripley, he is a preppy, boyish, and charming.
You're saying Ripley is?
Yeah, yeah. And he pretends to be something he's not. He's really skilled at again, improv. He's
impersonation, yes-ands
people. And he lets them fill in the gaps of, like, you know, he basically just... He's really charming because he's able to agree with everyone and let them assume that he is
very affable human being. Yeah,
they assume that he went to Yale, I guess, or Princeton.
Princeton, I think it was the school.
And they assume that he is rich, and they assume that he is a college educated lad. Yep. But and this is a character that Matt Damon plays up again, like this sort of a double agent role. In The Departed.
He does, yeah.
Yeah. And he this is a good character for Matt Damon.
Well, this is almost like the passive version of his character from School Ties as well. Like the rich preppy kid from the boarding school.
Or even his breakout role, Good Will Hunting.
Right.
Sort of having a dual identity.
Which was just around just a little bit before this, a year or so before.
And you were saying that he actually got the role for this movie because of his performance in Good Will Hunting?
He did. Yeah, they looked at a lot of other actors. Christian Bale. I watched it with a friend, and we were discussing who else would work in this role. I think Christian Bale would have done a good job. They also went out to DiCaprio, who I thought about initially when I was watching this for the second time.
I could see that. Well, DiCaprio also played a double agent in The Departed.
Right, exactly. So, they both did.
Exactly.
So I thought any of those actors would have done a solid job here. But this was a great Matt Damon's, I mean, for lack of a better term, was coming out party. He was starting to really push himself after writing and acting in Good Will Hunting. He started to get offered, really solid roles, and this is one of them. I think a year later he did Rounders.
So
he was starting to do some cool work.
Sure, Rounders
is one we need to talk about at some point.
Movies about degenerate gambling.
Yeah,
can't get enough.
We can. I know just who to ask to join us for that one.
And New York has a vibrant underground poker and gambling scene.
Oh, definitely did. I came here in the early 2000s, and we found a couple of those underground rooms. You had to go look into a camera and get escorted in. It was definitely run by Russians.
Sure.
Yep.
Sure. They love it.
Putting check by checkers next to doctors and playing for high stakes. It was silly. You can get in over your head very fast.
And, so did you, how did, Why'd you pick this one? Was it just because it was on Netflix?
I mean, that's one of the reasons, sure.
Had you seen it before?
I had. I've seen it a couple times. It was one of those ones that played on HBO or some movie channel that I always caught bits and pieces of. So, I mean, I've seen it in pieces before, but I've seen it all the way through as well years ago. I think there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
And, it's an interesting film. And I thought it would just be a fun one to review because it's got a little bit of everything in it.
Well, you know, I got to say that I loved how it looked. Mm-hmm. I liked all the sets.
Yeah.
And I really liked watching Matt Damon. I think he's actually a great actor in this specifically.
Yeah.
When we first run into him, I want to see him succeed. Like within the first couple minutes when he's charming these people and he just yes ands them that he went to Princeton.
Right.
And then we find out that he had he just borrowed that jacket with the Princeton letter on it to look good at this event. Then I go, okay, he's like Fletch, you know, if you've seen Fletch, the Chevy Chase film.
Chevy Chase film, yep.
Sure, which is like a comedic version of this. and he's just able to play. He's a fish that can swim in any fishbowl.
Mm.
And then
now that scene you're talking about when they're on the Upper West Side, obviously in New York, because they're high society, and he's obviously a more working class kid because he's a bathroom attendant at one point. But he's found at a party by Dickie Greenleaf's dad, impersonating another Princeton graduate who had apparently broken his arm. So they paid him to do that for them.
Oh wow!
So that's how he got into the circle. There's a very quick scene when he's walking out, and you see him hand the jacket back into a car. They thank him for helping out, and then they show him going back to his real life, which is a bathroom attendant living in like a...
What a terrible job that even exists, bathroom attendant.
Yeah, like, what a demeaning situation for everybody. It's just super uncomfortable.
And I used to do an open mic at a comedy club called Comics in the Meatpacking District, and they had a bathroom attendant there. And it was the most incongruous thing you could have, because every open mic comic, this is like 4 p.m., just neck beards, just dudes wearing Fantastic Four t-shirts, schlubby JNCO jeans, fucking beat up Vans. And then if you went to the bathroom, there was this well-dressed immigrant in an immaculate white jacket who was just waiting hand and foot for you to finish taking a dump in that bathroom. And then to be like breath mint, or trying to brush off people's dirty
handing
Uniqlo hoodies,
gum or napkins, and it's just it's the worst.
And they had the comedy pumping in through the speaker in the bathroom.
Not just to keep them entertained, at least. They give them a chair.
So we had to listen to people bomb the whole time.
Literally and figuratively.
And the audience wasn't mic'd, so it's not that there were laughs anyway, but there's something so off-putting about just hearing
a one-on-one joke,
the vocals of the jokes, without any crowd response.
that sounds like comedic water torture, dude. That's awful. Right, I've been to a few places
that
have these guys.
They can play that in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah, probably. Just watching one-liners just die. out of context completely.
Yeah, it's the worst job.
While you're waiting for somebody to wrap up their BM.
So he's an okay bathroom attendant, but an even better piano player. He sneaks piano lessons to himself.
Yeah.
After the performances. So
apparently, Jude Law learned to play the saxophone, and Matt Damon actually learned to play the piano for these roles.
Yeah. And I thought about this character, Mr. Ripley. He's such a talented impressionist,
Mm-hmm.
He looked like a young Phil Hartman.
Yeah.
If only there was an SNL at that time in the 50s.
Right.
Maybe he wouldn't have indulged in a life of crime.
What were they doing for that back then? Vaudeville? That was probably not still around.
Well, there was the early improv scene coming out of Chicago. Was a bunch of University of Chicago kids that became the Compass Players.
Right, Del Close, right?
He may have been a little bit later, but he was part of that early community. There was Alan Arkin was one of those guys. And so this character, Mr. Ripley, could have just gone to Chicago and started doing some yes-anding on a stage.
Yep.
And he is great as a sponge and so he's in the Meatpacking District, and which is where, in Sex and the City, who lives there? It's not Miranda.
Which one?
One of the ladies.
The Kim Cattrall's character.
Yeah.
Name.
Yeah. Living in the meatpacking.
Samantha.
I don't think anybody lives there now.
No. Can you live there?
Sure. I mean, if you're you got to be super wealthy.
Right.
But back then, this actually was a legit. It was extra meaty. Mm-hmm. We see Matt Damon walk out of his like two stories below ground apartment.
Yeah, he lives underneath the Western Beef outlet.
And extra meat, you know, just hanging pig carcasses
right.
in the sun, in the summertime.
It's a tough one to live.
On a cobblestone street.
Yeah, that's going to become a reality around here pretty soon.
Yes, I live above a meat shop that's reopening. Which, shop. Ironically, is next to a vegan cupcake shop.
That looks like a passport photo spot. Can't tell if there's all vegan cupcakes in there.
Possibly both owned by the same landlord.
Yeah.
So how's that making money hand over fist off of both ideological extremes?
Yeah, the only issue is you walk by those places and no one's ever in them.
Yeah.
So
bad marketing.
Bad marketing. Here we go. It was fun seeing Matt Damon as a bathroom attendant for me. Just fun to see him work.
And he gets this – what a dream job he gets. Mm-hmm. Mr. Greenleaf,
yeah.
The father, he gives Matt $1,000 and a free pass on the Cunard cruise lines to go to Europe and bring back his son. Mm. I want that job.
Yeah, who doesn't want that job? I'll take it.
Sure.
I would love to murder narcissistic trust fund babies.
So this becomes – it becomes a horror movie because – well, I don't know. Like, it's not traditional horror, but I would call it a psychological crime drama.
Sure.
It's a crime drama. It's a thriller.
Thriller.
And
thriller's fair.
And we see Mr. Ripley, you know, long story short, he goes to Europe and he wants to first befriend Jude Law's character, Dickie Greenleaf, and then he wants – and then after that, he decides he wants to become him.
Can you use the term seduce in a non-sexual manner?
Yeah, I would say seduction is, you know, defined by making somebody fall for you.
Yeah.
Become attracted to you,
mm-hmm.
need you, obsess over you.
Ingratiate you into his life.
Sure. Well, he's good. He's good at this. He's the worm in the apple. He knows how to burrow deep.
Yep.
Deep to get to the core.
Dickie Greenleaf, one of my favorite villains we've ever covered. He's a villain to me.
Yeah?
As much as anyone. Yeah, absolutely he is.
So Jude Law's pretty boy is a bad guy. And let's look at Dickie. Dickie is a trust fund kid from Princeton. He is running away, shirking his responsibilities. He doesn't want to become the head of the Greenleaf Shipping Company.
He's finding himself in Europe as do most affluent children right after college.
Yeah, and he's got a girlfriend in Europe played mm-hmm. by the one and the only Goop Queen, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Lady Goop.
Lady Goops. Gwyneth Paltrow plays Marge, who is a burgeoning writer who's working on a novel.
Aren't we all?
And yeah. Monji Bello. I'm working on a novel, too. I'm on page 3.
Nice.
Yes.
The premise.
I'm still fleshing it out, yeah. Still fleshing out the ideas. And so Marge and Dickie live a happy life right on the beach mm-hmm. in sun-bathed Italy. And it's beautiful. I love seeing these scenes of Italy because, you know, there's no plastic yet. There's no billboards. It's nothing. It's
autentico.
Yeah.
It's rustico.
It's very bespoke.
Yes, it is. But there we go.
And I don't understand how they're out in the sun every day with no sunscreen. You know,
we weren't worried about it back then.
Yeah.
If melanoma doesn't exist medically yet, then how can you have it? You know, ignorance is bliss, Gabe. That's where he delivers the most annoying line that made me dislike him almost immediately.
Yeah, what is it that you hate about Dickie? Let's break it down.
I mean, what do you like about him? He's a hipster poser, rich kid.
He loves jazz.
Pretends to love jazz.
He's got a boat.
Right.
A little sailboat called the Bird.
Loves smoking grass and making martinis. He's basically like, they're like Benjamin Buttons's. Like, they're all like 65-year-old men trapped in the bodies of children with these weird sort of hipster ideologies. You know, when Ripley introduces himself initially at the beach in Italy, I'm guessing it's the Amalfi Coast. We're just going to say it is. I don't care if it isn't. You get the picture. Well, it's in Naples, southern Italy.
Yeah, Mangibello's a fake. It's fake.
Oh, it's fake. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So they made up this town
so we'll
the
say
movie.
Coastal Italy. Coastal southern Italy, blah, blah, blah. And then he, you know, he introduced Tom Ripley. I know you. And he goes, do I know you? Yeah. I mean, if I know you, you know me. Great way to introduce and completely just throw someone off your scent. He does it a couple of times brilliantly, by the way. When he's talking to Cate Blanchett, they run into each other. Cate Blanchett took a very small role because the director wanted her in the film so bad that he actually made that role slightly larger.
Yeah, I think it's a made-up role. They added that to the script.
It 100% was.
Because this was first a movie. This was a novel before it was a movie written by Patricia Highsmith.
Mm-hmm.
And they created the Cate Blanchett character for this. Yeah. Very fun.
Yeah.
She kills it.
She does great. So she runs into Dickie on his way, Tom Ripley on his way to go to Italy to, you know, get pretend to get his Dickie Greenleaf back. He pretends to be Dickie Greenleaf the first time there in front of her. She's like, "Why are you in the R's? You know, you're getting on the." He's like, "I'm," you know. He explains who he is, and
yeah.
Then she's like, "Well, why are you in the R line if your last name is Greenleaf?" And he goes, "That's my mother's last. I'm using my mother's last name because I don't want anyone to make a big deal about who I am." And then she's like, "Oh, what's your mother's name?" And he goes, "Emily." Instead of using the last name because he couldn't think of one, didn't want to give Ripley out. And then he just stares at her and kind of smiles enough to just completely throw her off so she doesn't ask a follow-up question. It was kind of brilliant.
Yeah, he does a good job. And then she assumes that this is just how the wealthy 1% travel under false identities.
Right.
And, it made me think about Hollywood celebrities who get prosthetic noses. Or beards.
You mean Mel Gibson?
Funny glasses. Yeah. to go be one among the people. It's
right.
Like, I just want to go and get myself a black and white at Shake Shack today. Yeah. And maybe a double shake burger. So I got to put on my prosthetic nose, my bulbous.
That thing worked for Gibson for a long time.
Really?
Yeah.
I got
several months of wear out of that thing.
That's fun. I hope there are pictures that I can find online.
I'm sure there are. We can post one while we're promoting.
Yeah.
So the line that bugged me about Dickie Greenleaf is after Ripley introduces himself as Tom Ripley, we went to school together. Oh, I don't remember exactly. He's like Princeton was such a fog, and then he goes, America's such a fog. And I was like, I don't like you, dude. Immediately, that was enough for me.
Sure.
To dislike him, just a
yeah,
a blue blood jerk off.
And they're so easy to I said rich people are polite in most situations,
mm-hmm.
and they're gracious because everyone is serving them.
Right.
So they can afford to be nice, but they're also easy marks because they're so nice. You know?
Yeah.
Like Dickie's got no boundaries,
right.
Which allows for our boy, Mr. Ripley, to insinuate himself into a circle.
Well, they can also use people up with zero repercussions, like Dickie's been doing to people left and right, you know, for the most part.
Yeah, Dickie is not a nice guy. He's he is cheating on Marge,
mm-hmm.
who desperately loves him and wants to marry him.
Yeah,
and but he's having an affair with Silvana,
mm-hmm.
our.
Just a hardworking
village girl,
yeah.
Yes.
I was going to say that I think, they're having an affair. I guess you can't really call it an affair. Well, I mean, technically, he's sleeping with
two or three.
It's a tryst, sure. Yeah, he's on vacation. She becomes pregnant as the plot thickens. Can't tell him about it because he's just a...
Because he's never around. Every time she says, "Hey, I got to talk to you," he's like, and hops on his Vespa.
Yeah.
Says, "Ciao."
Or gets in a boat.
Yeah.
So she's pregnant with his child, unbeknownst to anyone.
Yeah, and there's no abortions, probably, in this Catholic country.
I was going to say, I think...
very little sex ed, very little medical help available.
And just a shit ton of guilt. I'm pretty sure that wealthy Protestants and guilt killed more Catholics in Europe than the plague did.
Yeah. So he's an exploiter and a user, and... and Ripley sees this and he judges him maybe, but he also is keeping his secrets because he thinks that by gaining Dickie's confidence,
mm-hmm.
they'll become better friends.
Who does this sound a lot like to you, by the way, this Greenleaf kid? Just say he's in charge of way too much right now.
Oh,
we'll put it that way. politically.
I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah. Narcissistic trust fund, baby.
Sure.
Yeah. Thin skin manipulative, lets people in his inner circle, secret keeper. That's kind of why I hate this guy.
Right.
Anyone like him. Anyway.
And
that's a parallel I made in my mind when I was watching the movie. I was like, fuck this guy.
But the thing is that so Ripley ingratiates himself with Dickie by doing a spot on impression of his father.
Yeah.
And it made me think, well, what a cool way to make friends with people. Mm-hmm. You know, in The Breakfast Club.
Smart.
I see every character in that movie does an impression of their own father.
Right.
And you know, and it's therapy for them. But with this, we see somebody else doing an impression of the father, and Dickie can't get enough of it. So I think Ripley should have kept up with being entertaining. But after he gets in, he kind of becomes a puppy dog. He gets a big crush on Dickie.
Yeah, that's the problem, is he caught feelings.
Yeah, he doesn't know how to keep that aloofness that gets people to like you. He gets too needy.
Well, the way he really sort of ingratiated himself into Dickie's circle was not only the impression made Dickie laugh, and was like, that's uncanny. How do you know? And then he tells him, and then he does the impression of what his father told him, go back and get my son. So he lets him know, to gain his trust, that he's there to get him back. So his dad was, you know, using a con arm.
He's fully transparent. Hmm? He tells him all the right things.
That's how you do it.
That's the opposite of a rom-com. Mm-hmm. In the rom-com, there's always this sort of a lie that needs to be revealed.
It's a very Giuliani move.
In this, he's a full disclosure.
Right.
I'm here to get you.
Yep.
And they go listen to jazz together.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of the Tim Heidecker character, and I Think You Should Leave. Like these jazz nerds.
Okay.
Just talking about just like, oh yeah, Brubaker. Oh yeah. Like Bird, you listen to Bird? That's what I named my boat. It's so lame to like somebody based on the pop culture things that you both share.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't mean and this is in High Fidelity, you know.
Right.
Basically when they're all just communicating on the superficial level of like,
it's like they took like the high school judgmental nature of musical choices and just kept it going well into their 20s.
Yes.
Yeah. I still do that sometimes based on some music, but you know.
You know what I like though is that they this way of and I'm going to be referencing all of these films that we've already covered or will be covering, mm-hmm. but In the Net with Sandra Bullock, the hitman who follows her around and seduces her also has found out everything about her, I think maybe from online. Mm-hmm. So he then creates the perfect character for her to fall in love with.
Yeah.
And that is what our boy, Mr. Ripley, is able to do too.
Right.
You know, he just figures out what Dickie likes and then mirrors it back to him.
I mean, another movie this reminds me of in a way, just like a slightly different version, better.
Yeah.
It's basically, it's Cruel Intentions with a rock solid script, a better cast, better acting, better pacing, better director, better plot line.
But Cruel Intentions had a better on-screen girl-on-girl kiss, according to MTV.
Yeah, I mean, right. They won, exactly.
Yes.
Was, you know, similar, you know, children of wealth manipulating people to get what they want with zero repercussions, because what's going to happen to them at the end? Except you'll die, I guess, is the moral of the story in one way or another. You'll get hit by a car or an oar.
And our boy Mr. Ripley is really good at doing impressions and also in forging people's signatures, mm-hmm. and writing letters in other people's hands.
Yep.
And he's watching Dickie write all of these letters, and you know, Dickie is dumb for having no boundaries and letting this guy who he doesn't know at all watch him live his life.
Yep.
Then there's a
takes him to the bank with him to deposit and cash checks. It's just it's
dummy.
It's the inner sanctum, right? Yeah. There, dude. You got to be careful.
Keep your money separate.
Yeah,
brah. There's a very homoerotic, sultry bathtub chess scene. Mm-hmm. Again, I wrote down no boundaries. Like Dickie's in the tub, naked, al dente, al fresco. Mm-hmm. Playing chess, mm-hmm. with Mr. Ripley. Mr. Ripley's fully clothed on the outside of the tub.
Yeah.
just staring
seems
at him.
Seems very intimate. You know what we'll never do, Gabe? Play chess while one of us is drawing a bath.
Yeah, it just sends the wrong message.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, why? Because he's he's, you know, unless you're down to clown, you don't you don't dangle
that term so much.
A sweet piece of tanned meat out for someone like that.
Someone who you just don't know and clearly has tendencies towards liking you.
Look, if you're putting that type of bait on the end of your fishing line, something's gonna bite.
You better reel something's gonna bite, and you better reel that shit in.
Yeah,
you don't want to be a tease.
So exactly. So Dickie's being a tease. That's the issue. Mm-hmm. And now
he really is, actually. I think purposefully.
Yeah, and Ripley's like, hey, you know, I want to get in that tub too, you know, and Dickie's like, yeah. Cool. Well, I'm done. And he gets out and he's like, you can get in. Ew, nasty. Get in someone else's bathwater.
But he was like, I don't mean with you in it.
Right.
Yeah. You're gay.
Yeah. And then I wondered, I didn't know if Ripley was gay, straight, or pansexual, mm-hmm. or just sort of whoever he was obsessed on would be what he was sexually attracted mm-hmm. to. If he was using sex as a weapon. You know, it reminds me of 13. Like the orphan in 13,
right?
Is she uses her sexuality with everyone to gain access?
Yeah, I mean, that's not uncommon among young people.
Yeah, is that what Ripley's doing, or is he actually a gay character?
His is a little less damaged and more just sociopathic because he just seems like an asexual predator. I mean, he's obviously, you can't. He doesn't make any plays on women. And he definitely has the ability to because they find him charming. So I believe that they are painting him as a pretty strict homosexual, yeah.
Sure.
And this goes into a question I was going to ask here is, you know, we've covered a lot of movies from this time, you know, the 80s and 90s, and it seems like there was only two types of gay characters at that point. Either like the stereotypical flamboyant gay character, like the Schumacher film, like St. Elmo's Fire, The Upstairs Neighbor.
Right.
Or you're getting Nathan Lane's character in The Birdcage, or you're getting Josh Jackson's character in Cruel Intentions. Very stereotypically gay, either over the top or sociopaths. Like you did in Basic Instinct with the lesbian partner,
who
was the tried to kill people.
Yeah,
not painting gay people in a great light.
I think I wrote that down in bold somewhere. I was like, not a good look.
I wrote it down.
LGBTQ community.
Absolutely, we talked about it a lot more, obviously, with Basic Instinct because that was one of the first films to address, that.
Yeah,
counterculture sexuality, whatever you wanted to call it, in the early 90s, and then
I thought there was so much more going on with this film, and that Ripley was such a fleshed out character that he came off as a sympathetic protagonist in this, and so it wouldn't be I can't put him entirely in the villain category or as a stereotype.
Yeah, so, it just seems like he got in over his head.
Right, he couldn't help himself with his lies.
Yeah,
and it's funny that the first lie that he tells in Italy to Cate Blanchett's character mm-hmm. is the one at the end. The callbacks. His first sin is the one that becomes the last sin, the thing that he eventually has to pay for.
So to kind of put this, if you know, just in case to keep it on a timeline. Dickie sort of grows tired of Tom's antics, or not antics, he bores of him, and he becomes too close, and I think Dickie's starting to feel a little uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
And I think awkward.
Yeah.
So he kind of runs out and says that he's not going to, they plan all these little elaborate trips within Italy, and then lets him know that he doesn't think he's going to have fun on the ski trip, so he kind of disinvites him, but has Marge disinvite him instead, and then runs into his other blue blood buddy, Philip Seymour Hoffman, whose cadence and voice, as an incredible actor as he is, just is incapable of being not creepy in most roles.
All right, when we meet Freddie Miles,
yeah.
Man, oh man, this guy is a scene stealer. He's chewing up all the scenery, the armoires, the tables, the chandeliers, the records in the shop. My man has a red Corvette convertible, drives it into the plaza, almost crashes it into a fountain, hops out of the car. He is the perfect ugly American abroad, and I think it also broke the spell because Dickie only has one bro with him. You know, he's only got Ripley with him, so you know, when there's a scarcity of resources, you're going to think, okay, this what I've got is good enough.
Yeah.
And then Freddie Miles comes in larger than life.
Yeah. This
and you see immediately, oh, why am I hanging out with this Herb when I could be hanging out with Freddie?
Well, this other kid who I know is rich and gregarious and fun and just wants to get drunk and party.
Yeah, and then they go to a record store together. They do a record listening sesh in a booth.
They sure do.
Which is pretty cool. Reminds me of going to Sam Goody's.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore.
We sure don't.
No, well, I got Spotify now.
Right.
I'm not going to pull these headphones off and be like, hey, Sammy, listen to this one song with me through one ear.
Please.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
No.
So, Freddie, Philip, he does a great job. He almost channels a Jack Blackian performance. You know,
yeah.
I think he's a more a Jack Black with more range.
Right. I mean, I think at this point you can call it an actual. He channels a Philip Seymour Hoffman performance out of it.
He feels like a character out of a Bret Easton Ellis story.
I could see that.
You know,
it's also a continuation of a character he did with The Scent of a Woman. Was basically he played sort of a scoundrelly, no good prep school kid.
Can I tell you this? We probably have to review that movie because I haven't seen it yet.
Scent of a Woman?
That's right.
Okay, great.
So
there we go. That's on
we'll
the list.
Put that on the list, yeah. And Dickie love bombs people, you know. He which is a term that I think of from cults. So when you first join a cult, there's this the first couple days, everybody welcomes you, they make strong eye contact, they shake your hands, they flirt with you, they feed you. And then after that, things become a little bit more controlling. And so Dickie, and I think Marge brings this up. You know, that's part of his charm, but also what makes him an asshole. It's like he showed Ripley all of this attention.
Yeah.
And now the minute that Freddie Miles comes back into his life, he
has
just
no,
gets
no
cold.
Use. Yeah.
Right.
Well, she says it best. Yeah, she explains his, you know, his pattern. But she said, you know, he can also, he's charming enough and good looking enough to woo you and make you feel like you're the only person ever. And then as soon as you've sort of outworn your use, next.
So there's a phenomenon that happens with people who have lost family members early in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that this term, it's like object impermanence.
Okay.
So when you're like, let's say you're orphaned, or what that can manifest to later in your relationships is like this clingy jealousy,
mm-hmm.
because you're scared that you're going to lose whatever it is that you have. So a character in a movie that kind of has this is Anakin Skywalker in Star Wars, right? Like he gets with Padme and then he just, once he has her, he's like, she's the one. And he gets like sickly and addicted to like maintaining and controlling her. And I wonder what is in Ripley's background, because he could have maintained having a relationship with Dickie if he had just been chill, but instead he does the hangdog, sad, like following him around, like Dickie, like Dickie's having fun with Freddie, and he's like, Dickie, we need to go do that thing that you said aren't we gonna go get a suit together?
Yeah, he feels like threatened.
Yeah, and it's like, dude, if you just fuck acted like come get me, it would have been fine.
Yeah.
But this is a trait that people have to think about when they're in relationships, like not showing too much jealousy or neediness.
Mm-hmm. Because so it's true.
It
nothing drives people away faster than that.
than that stink of desperation.
Yeah. But why?
Yeah. Because he would eventually get tired with Freddie or become friends with Freddie as well.
No, like, they belong together.
Yeah.
Best pairing in the film.
Right. He could have... I don't know. That's just – I was thinking about strategies that Ripley could have used to make his situation better.
People always want what they can't have.
Yeah. So
– or it's harder to attain.
So the money runs out.
And, yes.
Ripley gets a letter from Mr. Greenleaf, the father, who says, well, you just got to come back. I'm not going to give you any more money. And at this point, our boy Dickie is like, well, I can't pay for you to hang out with me, but we can go together to San Remo for one last trip before you head back to the United States. They go to San Remo. They get on a boat. On the boat, he calls Ripley a leech. And that should have been the end of it. It's like, okay, you're a leech. Cool. Like, but But Ripley gets really passionate, emotional. They have a little struggle on the boat, and he hits him with an oar. And it doesn't feel premeditated. It feels like, well, he made an accident, and now he's got to deal with the repercussions of this accident. Mm-hmm. He's got to murder Dickie. And then, obviously, the next step, take his identity.
Right.
And this is the turn. This is the turn in the movie.
Right. Oh, and just for plot's sake, the woman that he impregnated, Sylvana, ends up killing herself.
Uh-huh.
And then you see sort of a bit of humanity out of Dickie Greenleaf directly before he's murdered by Tom. Manslaughtered. No, he's definitely not premeditated, but a scuffle turns into something and you have to finish the job.
He's got to finish the job. Yeah. And then the creepy thing about this is after he murders Dickie, you see him spooning the corpse.
Oh, in right. The boat. Yeah, yeah.
And that reminded me of Jeffrey Dahmer, who was another murderer who I think had some of this object impermanence, this disorder, because when they asked Dahmer about why he killed people, it was a lot of the motivation was that he just didn't want them to leave him. So he would have like one night stands with these guys, and then he's like, well, but I didn't want them to go in the morning.
Right.
So I'm going to kill them. Now they're here. And then he'd just keep them until they stunk too much and, you know, put them in the acid vats and then go out and do it again. But this scene made me think of Dahmer.
Yeah.
This sort of like this need to keep the thing, the object that you love close by, even if it means killing them. Mm-hmm. And then we see Dickie running around in Rome, feeling fine. Ripley.
Who now, assumed Dickie's identity.
That's why I made the mistake.
Correct.
So Ripley mistake. Becomes Dickie.
They made you make that mistake.
Seamless transition.
Right.
And he's living his best life. And then, oh, God, then I get anxious and tense because Cate Blanchett shows back up.
Right.
And she knows Ripley as Dickie because he stupidly lied for no reason at the beginning of his trip to Rome.
So the tangled web becomes more tangled.
Yeah. You never get caught for your last sin. You get caught for your first sin at the end of your life. And so she's clingy, and she is also a creature with no boundaries. Kind of a mirror of Ripley, I'd say. You know, she catches feelings over the course of a day for his character.
Smitten.
Yeah. Why, though? You know, he's such a cipher. It's not that he's doing anything at all other than, like, nodding and shaking his head and agreeing. He's not a gregarious guy.
No. He's a young, good-looking man.
Yeah. Maybe she's just looking for anyone who is of her wealth.
Yeah, and he was also charming enough in the beginning. He made a couple of jokes to, you know, get her to chuckle. Sometimes that's all it takes.
I like Dickie's Dickie Ripley's cool subterfuge. Yeah. How he checks in. Ripley checks into a hotel as Dickie, and he checks into one as Ripley, and then he has phone calls back and forth to create a paper trail where it seems like they've been communicating.
Oh, he's an outstanding con man.
Yes.
Yeah, he's like Frank Abagnale from Catch Me If You Can levels. He's good at what he does.
And
he just told too many lies in this instance, and they all came back to haunt him. They didn't know that all rich people from the East Coast in America party in the same Italian cities.
Yeah, yeah. They're all in the same black book together.
That's exactly right.
Epstein's
Island,
Little St. James Island, which sounds like it. You know, it's got a cuter name than what it will forever be known for.
Yeah.
The rest of this film is just kind of a spiral out of control.
Yeah.
There's another cool character. I didn't write his name down, but Ripley falls for a rich gay man. And it seems as though they could be happy together.
The British man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So sad that he finally has a partner who accepts him, kind of, for who he is. And they...
For who he thinks he is, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. And through a set of fortunate circumstances, Mr. Greenleaf, Dickie's father, thinks that that Ripley deserves Dickie's inheritance. So he's set for life. You know, he would have Dickie's trust and like money,
right?
And he would have a male lover. Unfortunately, on the cruise ship at the end, he runs into Kate Blanchett's character again, and she only knows him as Dickie Greenleaf. So the whole ruse is going to be up. And he can't kill her because she's surrounded by too many family members that have already seen him. Wow, that's got to be infuriating.
Yep.
You just want to throw somebody off a boat, and then you look up and their parents are there.
Right, like dead zone.
Terrible. Yeah, so Dickie and so Ripley, I keep calling him Dickie, but Ripley, Matt Damon,
yeah,
he kills his lover, smothers him in the bedroom. What's he going to do with the body now? He's got to wait till midnight to toss it overboard or just keep it under the bed and have it stink like one of Dahmer's victims.
Yeah, all comes back to Dahmer. Or just wait till the crib and we'll see what happens. We've got about a day.
And can he stay in the in the boat the whole time in his room without Kate Blanchett looking for him? Like, how long is this trip?
It's true.
How long? 2-3 weeks?
It's got to be.
He's got to order room service the whole time, have cheese and crackers. And
delivered to his...
Yeah.
Corpsey hotel room, or his corpsey cruise ship room.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gross. Not a way to live.
God. It's so much simpler now that we have airplanes.
Yeah. Oh, man. So true. People still take cruises.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I'm going to take a cruise again. I'll tell you why.
I never will. I just don't. Well, maybe in Alaska I would do that one thing. But
so I did that with my grandma when I was in middle school, went to Alaska. And you see, we were just watching these glaciers melt, just chunks of them fall off into the ocean.
Now very sad.
And at the time, global warming wasn't quite, didn't have the same cachet as a
or none at all concept at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, oh, this just happens naturally because it's springtime in Alaska. And that's what we thought. But now I see it as like Ragnarok. It's apocalyptic. It's the end of the Earth as we know it.
Right.
It's these glaciers falling in.
Yeah.
You know, it's the Earth's receding hairline.
Yeah.
And so what a bummer. But one thing that I hear about cruises is that when it ports, when it docks in a port, all of the local flora and fauna, right, like the local algae and barnacles and things, they get attached to the ship. And then it goes off to another port. And you're just introducing these foreign species into and devastating the ecologies of all of the local shorelines by doing that. And then they just dump so much raw sewage
and
refuse into the ocean.
That's true.
For no reason. Because people who are on these ships are just like, I want to eat at the midnight buffet. I want to watch Zoolander in my room. I want to go in the pool. The chlorinated pool, like there's no reason to be on the ship. Like, you know, what are you doing on the ship? I'm gambling.
It's literally travel in its lowest form. I mean, it's there's no cultural experience on a lot of these cruises. You stop at a port for a day and a half where you're just like surrounded by commerce and people selling things.
Yeah.
You don't get any cultural aspects of any of the places you visit. You're there for too little time and at a place where it's just set up for you to buy.
God, I'm rooting for the Somalian pirates to really step their game up
and
start
really
taking over
ships,
some carnival ships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love that. That would be amazing. We should do a remake of that. We could do a remake of Jaws where the shark just attacks Japanese whale fishermen and Chinese shark fin supers.
Yes, sir.
And then some Captain Phillips, but they only go after carnival cruise ship directors.
So you have any final thoughts for this?
No, I mean, this is a good movie. I always appreciated that just for the performances. It's a good film. Good to watch.
Dude, great Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Great, yes.
Great Kate Blanchett.
All of them were great. Even Jude Law, who's.
Yeah, it was a wonderful cast. The setting was fantastic.
Yep.
Italy was cool. I thought the movie lagged a tiny bit in the middle. Right after Dickie gets killed by Ripley.
I think it could have been about a half hour shorter.
We could have shaved it.
They could have shaved it down. A little editing.
Yeah, just a tiny trim off the top.
They were trying to make it a tour de force.
And the location where this was filmed was in Positano, Italy.
Yeah, they actually filmed the original New York scenes in the beginning in Italy, but didn't like the way it looked, so had to refilm again a little bit in New York. But yeah, I mean, 98% of the film was shot in Italy. Beautiful.
Want to
go.
You know me, man. I love the thrillers. Yeah. I like single white female. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of my choices.
Sure, this is single white male.
It is.
No.
And so I like that about it. I like movies where uh-huh. somebody floats above their class and enters new class. Another film I want to watch after seeing this was 6 Degrees of Separation, which is a Will Smith tour de force where he ingratiates himself into a wealthy family.
Yeah.
So overall, this is on Netflix. It's free to watch right now, so if you have Netflix. And I would give it a 7 strangled gay lovers on a boat out of 10.
That's a lot of that's 7?
7.
I think 7's a good number.
Yeah.
I would give it just based on Damon's performance and the collective cast, which you're not going to ever see that many quality actors in a film again from that time period. It's kind of difficult. All like rife with Oscar nominees and Oscar winners. I'll give it 7 boxes of male jewelry. 7, yeah, 7. Actually, I'll give it 8.
Why are you wearing Dickie's rings?
You don't ever take them off.
Ugh.
8 boxes of male jewelry.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, there it is.
Cool.
We've covered it. The talented Mr. Ripley. Once again, I'm Gabe Pacheco.
Sammy Hamarne.
And this is Eat, Pray, Judge. Please rate, review, and subscribe. And we will have a new episode for you next week. We love you.
Follow us on Instagram. Bye-bye. Yep.